Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
This is sort of a presentation of some research on Amazon Mechanical Turk, but also just more of a, what I would like to, I guess, say is sort of a considered introduction to it. It's something between a guided tour and some academic analysis, and hopefully that'll sort of cover everybody in the room and give you something to think about. So I hope we'll be able to talk about it more. I've been having a great time learning about Mechanical Turk since I've been using it. So I look forward to questions and discussions and other comments that people may have about it. So what's Mechanical Turk? For those of you who haven't messed around with this thing yet, it's a website. It's basically, as it says on there, a marketplace for work. And there are two main groups of end users, which are sort of the two sides of this webpage. One are workers and one are requesters. And the workers are people who have accounts and log in and sign up for jobs. And requesters are the people who post the jobs. And generally, the jobs are pretty much small-scale tasks that are paid for, that are paid, but in very small increments of money. So it might be something like labeling images, and you get 2 cents an image, or something like that. And that actually may be optimistic, and maybe more like you get 2 cents for 10 images. But in any event, that's the sort of underlying thing that's going on that we're talking about. And the name, everybody always wants to know about the name. The original name comes from a chess-playing automaton in the 18th century, which is pretty exciting. So actually, there's the Turk. This is actually a wooden statue. And the idea was that this box would have been covered up, and there was a chessboard on top. And it looked like the wooden statue guy was just playing chess. But in fact, as you can see from this cross-section, there was a very small chess grandmaster that could be cleverly hidden inside. So the tag for that Amazon applied to their thing, and the reason they claim to have chosen this name, is that the idea is that it's artificial intelligence. It's stuff that people are doing that requires human intelligence and skill, but which, for all intents and purposes, looks like it could be something that a machine was doing. So back to the platform. The other thing that everybody sort of likes to find out is, like, what's it actually like? And I was going to see, I think I'm still logged in here, if we couldn't actually do a hit, just to give you a sense, this is sort of what the interface looks like when you're logged in as a worker. Let's see if there's something very small. Oh, here we go. Type in 3 short pieces of text from an image. Let's check that one out. Oh, no more hits available in that group. Uh-oh. I may have already... did I already do that one? Hard to believe. I don't do a lot of these, as you can tell. Nope. Apparently, I can't do that one. Let's assess my English fluency. Oh, my. Final word index. It's too complicated. I'm not going to accept this one. Anyway, gives you the basic idea. If I did this task, if I were smart enough to handle this task, I would earn 1 cent for it. So what that creates is this sort of... you know, I think what's interesting about the system here is that it's structured in such a way that it facilitates certain kinds of interactions for the workers and elicits certain kinds of tasks that the requesters would be inclined to put up. So I just wanted to sort of lay that out ahead of time just so people had a sense of what we were actually talking about. Before going into the more interesting questions, which are things like, does it work? So the short answer to this, I would say, is it depends. Like all things, there are, you know, benefits to designing your tasks well. Framing long-worded questions and offering people a penny may not be the best way to go about it. And designing the way that people answer those questions is also critical. Aggregating and filtering the answers often helps, which was demonstrated in this nice study that some folks out in the Bay Area did, where the only thing you really need to know about these graphs is that once you get a few people performing these tasks, the accuracy rate goes up on all of them. These were actually natural language processing type tasks, so this was a demonstration that they could use it to train machine learning algorithms. So the aggregating and filtering the answers helps, and basically the good news is that it's not all bots, cheaters, and scripts, which is what everybody seems to assume when I tell them that I'm doing research using Mechanical Turk. And there are some nice structures in place by Amazon that make it, that put barriers in place to make it harder to do that. So, for example, you have to give them bank account information, which makes it less likely that you're going to create two or three accounts so that you can earn two pennies instead of one by logging in and out over and over again to do the jobs twice. Nevertheless, and this is a, for those of you who weren't here for last week's talk, you may not recognize this slide, but what all of this sort of leads me to is the point that skill of all kinds sort of matters, and I'm mangling what was a slide that Esther Hargitay used in her talk, in part to make the point that I think in Mechanical Turk, it's not just the skill of users that matters, their ability to read and follow instructions, answer the questions, do what it is the requesters are actually asking them to do, it's also the skill of the requesters. So whether or not you frame your task the right way is going to have an impact on the kind of results you get. So the next question that I think is worth bringing up is just who Turks and why? And the kind of most entertaining answer to this came in response to a blog post by a guy named Andy Bayo. And he got some nice photos, and some of these people included the reasons why they Turk. I think my favorite one, this guy, it says, I Turk for the lulz. There are a few others on there too. Or this one says, I Turk for drug money, which is nice. Glad to be supporting his habit. But the hard part about this is that there's really no public trustworthy data about the worker population. There have been some self-selecting surveys and experiments. Basically, people post hits on Turk, human intelligence tasks, hits on Turk, asking them to answer survey questions about themselves. But the problem is that there's no way to know if that is actually capturing an effective slice of the population. At the same time, and this has been echoed actually in some of the data that we've been collecting most recently, it seems like there are a lot of women. All of the self-selecting surveys seem to come up consistently with something like 50% or more women, which is interesting. And there are many countries of residence, but mostly the US and India. And in part, that's related to the banking restrictions that Amazon imposes on the payment system. As of, I think, May 2007, they made it possible for workers to get paid in Indian rupees with a certain set of identity cards that Indian citizens have. But other than that, you need to have a U.S. bank account, full stop. So contrary to popular belief, this is not, you know, necessarily everybody from the Global South logging on to the Internet to make a couple of extra pennies off of, you know, U.S. research budgets or something like that. It's a little different than that. And along with that, it seems like ages are low-ish and education and income are relatively high. So while it's hard to say at an aggregate level what that actually looks like, it does seem that there are a lot of people who are in their 20s and 30s in the U.S. who are doing this in their spare time. And the worker forums, of which there are a few, one is called Turker Nation, in case anybody wants to check it out, suggest that there are a range of experiences and skill levels going on here. So I think this is definitely something that, for my own purposes, I'm really interested in looking into it more closely. But which I don't think there's reliable information out there yet. So the next question is sort of, what do you do with this thing? And before I talk a little bit about what we've been doing in the cooperation research group with Mechanical Turk, or what we're trying to do, I thought I would just show a few examples of things that I think other folks have worked on that are interesting. So Amazon actually, maybe, I'm not sure, but developed the system to spam itself. So they basically use Turk to generate product descriptions or questions and answers to those questions about a product. So if you wanted to, Amazon needs information about this watch timer to supply to people who are going through the site, this watch winder, excuse me. And so they ask Turkers for, how much is this one paying? 5 cents a hit. To ask questions about the product and then answer those questions. And they're going to post that information on the site. Dolores Labs, which is a company based in San Francisco who, full disclosure, I will probably be doing some work with next year, has done some really interesting work with this as well. One example was they basically scaled Hot or Not by several orders of magnitude. The idea is that you upload photos of yourself, and then people judge your face in response to any questions you want to supply and that they want to supply. And what's interesting about it is they get a nice graph out of it like this, which is sort of an attractiveness scale by age, which apparently we have a lot to look forward to when we get over 60 or something. And other than that, I'm not sure what you do with this. But the interesting thing is that this has now been running on hundreds of thousands of faces with hundreds of thousands of respondents. So again, maybe not the best research data source for a general slice of the population, but an interesting application of what you can do when you have lots of people doing very small tasks and you can aggregate the results. Another company has got a business model where they're basically doing transcription, using Mechanical Turk to find workers and to distribute the tasks. And one of my favorite examples has been the work of an artist named Aaron Koblenz, who I believe is now based in San Francisco, but I think he was in LA when he did this. He basically posted a hit where he, in exchange for 2 cents, asked people to draw a sheep facing left. He then got 10,000 of these, and each one of these is a single sheep. As you can see, some of them are pretty awesome. Some of them a little less so. But it was an interesting experience. He's done other work. This is a $100 bill, which he recreated. Each one of these tiny rectangles, he provided a sort of printout of what was actually on the bill and then asked people to redraw it. So you get things like this where each of these pairs, so this is the left-hand side is what the original bill was, and this is the right-hand side what the Turker wrote. In this case, they did some squiggles and said, "I hate you." But I think he accepted it anyway, because it looks enough like the real thing that you don't notice when it's aggregated into 1/10,000th of a dollar bill, of a $100 bill. So interesting applications. And there's more than that, too. Some other things that I'm not going to talk about in any detail are a company called PicFu, which is trying to do market research using this. Another organization called Alias I, which is creating training sets for machine learning algorithms. And then finally, the stuff that I'm more interested in, which is how you might be able to use this to enhance social science. And so using Mechanical Turk to do social science, I think what I've seen so far is two big kind of areas of applications. One is to use Turkers as a pool of subjects for randomized experiments. And the other is to use them for as sort of inexpert raters, people who answer questions. This is usually called kind of coding or qualitative content analysis. Going backwards now. So I'm going to talk about each of the two for a little bit because we're actually working on things that involve both. And so I'll frame it a little bit and then I'll talk to you about the examples of what we've been up to. So for experiments, there are a few advantages to using Turk that make it attractive to folks who are used to having to do this in a lab on a university campus with paid undergraduates as your subject population. Among these, I think there are a few of them that, you know, probably need more research to actually figure out if it's true. The extent to which this holds up probably depends on a number of factors that are out of the researcher's control. And whether or not folks are in fact experiment savvy may change over time. So I don't want to present this as if it's like a definitive thing that, yes, AMT is perfect for experiments, but I think it has some advantages that are useful and interesting. The kinds of experiments that some folks that I've been working with and myself have been involved in involved usually contextualized real effort tasks. So this is taking advantage of the fact that we're in a real labor market when we're on Mechanical Turk. And I can ask someone to transcribe a passage of text, and they'll do it because it's just another job if they accept it. And they'll respond to it as if it's just another job. And so then when you introduce sort of treatments into these experiences, you're not dealing with folks who find themselves in a laboratory setting, which often makes it sort of questionable how generalizable experimental results are. You're dealing with someone who's already working in a labor market and has wandered into your job because it looks like others. So the two kinds of real effort tests, we've been working with two kinds of settings. One is sort of reproducing canonical games in economics. I have not been as involved in that. The other are paired surveys. And one of the example applications that we're working with right now is trying to use conduct an experiment to understand what actually motivates high quality work on Mechanical Turk. There's been very little work done to figure out how to get the best possible results out of the system. And it opens up the possibility of testing all these nice theories that social scientists have been, you know, carrying around for decades, but may not have had an opportunity to test against each other in as clear a way. So we've got a hit on Mechanical Turk. It's been created by Anita and Jason right over there. And basically, we're bouncing people to a Berkman site where we're asking them to look at some instructions and answer some questions about a website. And then we're exposing them to a treatment of some kind in the middle of the hit. So basically what we're doing is and I'm probably compromising the results of this horrendously by talking about this on the internet, but such is life. Some of the treatments include different sets of incentives and punishments, different threats about whether we're surveilling people or whether we're not, and giving people a chance to sort of succeed or fail in competition with a previous worker. And then exposing them to things like giving people things like including a picture to promote the humanization of the task. It's actually a picture of me that says, "Hi, my name's Aaron. I put this hit up.
Am I hot or not?"
My favorite one is the last one on here, which is a normative priming treatment, where we're basically asking people questions about the value of hard work before we expose them to the hit. And while we don't have any final results yet, the preliminary data that we've looked at suggests that that one is producing a significant improvement in some of the questions. So this is what one of the treatments looks like. This is the normative priming question. So in the middle of this larger questionnaire, we're asking you some questions about yourself and your attitudes about work. And then we get things like, people who don't work become lazy. How much do you agree or disagree? Work is a duty towards society. Agree or disagree? So we ask these questions, and then we ask them to answer our questions about the website, and we see what we get. So at the end of this, we're also including some demographic questions, because one of the problems with not knowing the population dynamics on Mechanical Turk is that it's very hard to understand how that population might be biasing the results we get. So we're asking people some questions about themselves, their income, where they live, how much education they've had, things like that, in order to be able to see whether our results on a particular treatment may be biased in relation to particular demographic attributes. So, and we're also asking people, this is another shout out to Esther, we're also asking people about their internet skill. This is something that hasn't been done on Mechanical Turk at all, because we're actually curious to see whether people's skill levels impacts how effectively they complete the tasks on a web-based survey interface. So that covers the experiment that we're working on. Now moving on to the kind of content analysis, or what I'm calling distributed observation. Content analysis is usually done with something like a coding instrument. The idea is that you come up with a list of questions you want to ask about something, say it's a batch of newspaper articles, and you want to find out how many times the Berkman Center gets mentioned in the New York Times during the last 2 years, and you want to understand whether the mentions are positive or negative, for a very simple example. Now you might do that with a machine learning algorithm, but what you would have had to do before machine learning algorithms became so stylish was you would have written up these questions, rounded up all the undergrads you knew, fed them as much pizza as you possibly could, or maybe paid them a few dollars an hour, and asked them to look through every article and answer the questions, and you would get people to repeat over certain articles so that you could figure out how reliable they were across these raters. The big question here is, how reliable is that information? The sort of guru of reliability and content analysis there is Klaus Krippendorf. He has a statistic named after him, which has been giving several of us around the table fits as we try to analyze some of this data. But my concern here is actually, even if you've got all your RAs and they wind up answering the same ways about the same sites and about the same articles in response to the same questions, you've actually introduced an element of bias by the training. And so what's interesting about using AMT to do this kind of task is that you can do a couple of things that are, I think, an improvement over traditional content analysis. First of all, you can get random assignment of the raters to the objects that they're coding. So instead of everybody and the questions that they're using. So instead of everybody doing all the questions about a series of articles, I can pick questions about any article and have any person answer them. The next thing is you can scale it really well. You can get more raters, more questions, more objects. I'm not limited by the number of undergrads or the amount of pizza that I may have because the cost is so much lower on Mechanical Turk. The third is this question of reproducibility. You don't have to train people. You just have to get your questions right so that people can answer them in a valid way. And so that's sort of leads into the example application that we've been working on lately as well, which is to do basically a large-scale survey of a lot of websites using this kind of method. So we have lots of websites, things like Couchsurfing, where people are collaborating on the internet. That's what we're generally interested in the cooperation group. And we want to ask questions like, does the site offer users social networking features? This is a sample question. And so this is actually part of our experiment right now is to test how well these questions are working on some of these websites. And eventually what we want to do is we want to be able to ask about 75 questions about, say, 1,000 websites. It's just something that would have been very, very difficult to do given the way that this research was historically done, and which is totally impossible using any sort of scraping method because the data is going to be very difficult to compare. So we're trying to bring together the advantages of human observation with the kind of scale that you can get with Mechanical Turk. So the big benefits that we think this will bring are not only do you extend and sort of scale up some social science methods that have been, I think, a little bit, you know, aging in recent years, you get to unlock data bottlenecks. So whereas it would have been hard to get access to this many sites, to analyze this many sites, now you can, you know, increase the size of your study by several orders of magnitude. And we're also, Jason and Anita in particular, building new software tools to make this possible. There's a whole sort of software end of this that runs that you need to use in order to assign the objects, assign the questions to folks, integrate with Mechanical Turk, handle the payments, and analyze the data afterwards. Also, we're looking to use this to improve reproducibility standards beyond the kind of practices that were used in the example I gave before with the newspaper analysis by undergrads. And also in the process, we're looking to understand AMT and crowdsourcing a little bit better. And so I guess that leads me to sort of wrapping up a bit. You know, I think there's a question here about what social science can do for Turking in addition to what Turking can do for social science. And so on the one hand, I think social science can help people Turk better. I think by doing these kinds of experiments, by understanding what motivates workers and how to design questions so that you get the best possible results, it also makes it possible to, you know, introduce demographic controls and understand your results in the context of the broader population. But on the other hand, I think there's another piece of this which may be, in the long term, more interesting. And it has to do with the fact that, you know, and to go back to Aaron Koblin's artwork, in some ways, the art that he asks people to do is sort of it feels a little bit glib because you're actually paying people this tiny amount of money to do a piece of art, and he now resells the sheep at $20 a pop. I don't want to malign him because I think he's actually started doing this, at least with the $100 bill one, where he donates that money to charity, so I don't want to make it sound like he's doing something completely unethical. But it introduces all of these interesting, tough questions about sort of outsourcing and, you know, basically using people's extra cycles to promote a larger project that they may not in the end get credit for or even fully understand in the context like Mechanical Turk. And I think social science has a lot to offer in terms of addressing some of these questions, if for no other reason than the circumstances of the people who were drawing the sheep would have sounded very familiar to that guy. So I think that analyzing the kind of context and impact of crowdsourcing work and distributed labor is maybe one of the next big areas that I'm looking to go in with one of the directions I'm looking to go in with this research. And I think there are a bunch of interesting questions here that extend way beyond Mechanical Turk. And some guy named Zittrain wrote an interesting article sort of looking at some of the ethical issues around this. But I would supplement the ethical questions with some questions just about understanding how these systems work. I think they're very poorly understood still, both in terms of the dynamics of power and the labor relations, the kind of culture that's cultivated among the people who participate, the dynamics of the organizations that use workers in this distributed fashion, as well as the psychology of participation in what Amazon calls the human command line. So I think there are a lot of big questions that are about how kind of knowledge-based economic activity and just distributed human action on the internet, what that means in a broader social sense. And so just to close, I think that usually this stuff is talked about as you've either got this sort of utopia of collective intelligence, the hive mind, or you've got child labor, or some sort of latter-day equivalent of child labor. And I think that both of those get a lot of the picture wrong. I think ultimately there's something that's a little bit more interesting, a broader spectrum of stuff that's going on, and I think a lot of it is still fairly poorly understood. So to close on that note, thanks very much, and look forward to the questions. Yeah.
Like this, honest, that they're actually doing the work they're supposed to be doing and not just, you know
shirking.
Putting in random input to, mm-hmm. whether it's a survey or whether it's transcribing text or identifying pictures or whatever, since they're getting paid before the work is evaluated, how does that work?
Well, actually, in Mechanical Turk, they're not paid before the work is evaluated. And it's one of the, I should have said a little bit more about this at the beginning. Mechanical Turk, there's the structure of it is actually, it severely favors the requesters in terms of how much information you get access to and sort of power over the transaction. Workers can do things like write, "I hate you," in the dollar, reproduction of that image. But ultimately, the requester has the ability to reject that work and not pay them. In fact, there have been some cases that Turkers have been complaining on the forums about where people will take the product, but still reject the work. So it's one of the things where I think there's some information inequalities and also just very basic rule issues that are problematic on Amazon. But I think each of the systems handles it a little differently. To give a different example, one of these organizations, Odesk, whose logo I included in the top left, is it's an outsourcing. They facilitate sort of outsourcing for development work. So you can go on there, and it's like Rent-A-Coder or something it's one of these kinds of services where you can go on there and you can buy a developer's time for completing a specific task. They actually, their application that they ask people to install lets the work requester look at the desktop of the worker while they're working. So it's this incredible, form of surveillance, which is meant to enforce productivity in a certain way. But I think it's an interesting problem that everybody runs into. I mean, for our own research purposes, I'm actually really interested in what proportion of the answers are crap. So I'm basically paying everybody and trying to filter it out after the fact at this stage.
To tell what's crap and what is not, because it's, you're farming out thousands of transcriptions, and how do you know which ones were good and which ones weren't?
Well, actually, I know Casting Words asks other Turkers to evaluate the work. So there are a few different techniques you can use. I think on one level, there's sort of organizational structural rules that you can put in place, like this sort of either I can accept or reject the work. There's sort of pre-processing stuff, so I can filter people based on where they're from or based on skill tests or things like that, and I can try to design my tasks as well as possible. Bless you. And then there's also the sort of post facto analysis piece where I can go through and I can ask workers to tell me, was that hard or easy? Did this person do a good job? I can clean up the data after the fact by giving people scores and ranking the results based on their scores. So there are lots of different techniques for it. So yeah, I don't know who's, yeah.
So do workers have identities and then you can build up credibility and handles and then they can build up credibility over time where you can track them across tasks?
With Mechanical Turk, workers have unique worker IDs, which is basically all the requester sees, unless they contact you in an email, in which case you see whatever email address they used. But so it's a little bit weird in the sense that there's not really a reputation system beyond what percentage of your work has been rejected or approved, which Amazon does track. So lots of tasks will qualify workers based on whether you have, you know, 90% or above approval rate. But ultimately, that doesn't really get at the quality of the work. It just says you did the minimum on your past job such that, you know, somebody like me was willing to pay you. I think it's an interesting question about whether Amazon would benefit from doing something like that. At the moment, one of the more interesting responses to these sorts of inequalities between workers and requesters within Amazon is that somebody's built a Firefox extension called Turkopticon, which makes it possible for requesters for workers to submit reputation information about requesters. So if I do a hit and so-and-so doesn't pay me or they reject my work, even though I did what they asked me to, I can go on there and, you know, give them negative karma, basically. But at the moment, it's a Firefox extension, hasn't been very widely installed, small audience of active users, but certainly an interesting experiment in that regard. So, yeah, Chris.
Can you maybe talk a little bit about the process of getting this past the IRB?
Mm-hmm.
Specifically with regard to any studies that involve either deception or not telling your users the whole truth and nothing but the truth?
Mm-hmm.
And was it Harvard or Cal?
We did this under Harvard's IRB. We're doing this under Harvard's IRB. Sorry, IRB, or Committee on Human Subjects Protection. It depends a little bit what university you're in. Basically, any research involving people, and involving people in a way that's not just using publicly available information about them or observing them in public spaces, and even usually those kinds of research too, requires that you submit basically some documentation telling the university what it is you're going to do and justifying your work. Oftentimes it boils down to an exercise in proving that you're not going to do anything that's going to get the university sued or endanger the subjects of your research in some way. Definitely was something we had to do with this research. It was actually really straightforward, in part because we're not collecting information that we think would be easy to identify as personal information. Even in some of those demographic questions, it's very general stuff that would be very hard to tie to an individual's identity. The worker IDs, I know nothing about anybody beyond a hash of numbers and letters that corresponds to their past performance and whatever work they contributed to my job. So it was actually fairly simple to make the case to the IRB that, look, we know very little about these folks. We're not collecting compromising information. We're not endangering them. And we're not, in the course of our studies, deceiving anybody, other than we're not saying explicitly that it's a study. And that's for the purposes of the research goal of preserving this labor market environment, which the IRB is totally cool with. There are lots of studies where they'll let you basically not tell people you're researching them as long as you meet the sort of standards for that. So. Do we have a website? Our project has a spot on the Berkman site, but nothing particular to this work. But yeah, we'll talk about it more afterwards, yeah. I have no idea who's next. Let's try some folks from the side aisle. And if you're on the side, can you just speak up a little bit, just because the microphones are in the middle of the table? They may have a hard time picking it up.
I'm curious about the rates of payment for these tasks. Like, as I was looking at the side of my phone and as I was looking at your screenshots, they seem almost obscenely low, like 1 cent, 5 cents. It seems that this is a labor market in which it's absolute free market rules and just bottom of the barrel. It seems kind of like a mass devaluation of labor for me. Is this sort of common that there are a lot of these 1 cent tasks, or, you know, is there ever a fair rate paid for the labor?
It varies a lot. No, and your question's a great one. It varies a lot. I think the numbers that I've seen from Amazon suggest that something like $1 to $3 an hour boils down to average on the system, but that's an average, right? So it's hard to know without actually scraping the entire site and looking at all of the rates of payment over time what that really means. Although I have a friend who's doing that. I think the bigger question behind what you're saying is like, how can this possibly make any sense to anybody? And I guess this is where I think it gets back to, you know, how do you understand the impact of this and how do you understand the experience of the people who are doing it? The payment rates are low by minimum wage standards. The work is also often very modular and small, and so wouldn't fit within the confines of a regular minimum wage job. And I think that it's
I think it is in some ways, as you put it, a devaluation of people's time. But at the same time, I think that it's a little bit difficult to say completely whether folks, you know, folks who are just doing this for the lulz, you know, they might also be contributing that time on something like The Extraordinaries, which is this iPhone app I mentioned where you can do kind of micro-volunteering. So if they make a few bucks to pay for some MP3s on the side, that may be more appealing to them for some reason. So
I guess my question is more that, you know, if a lot of companies who pay minimum wage could get away with paying people 10 cents an hour, they would.
Mm-hmm.
So we have laws and protections so that right. kind of exploitation doesn't happen, but these kind of laws don't exist for this type of labor online.
To my knowledge, no.
I mean, that seems to me to be a problem.
I agree. I agree completely. And I think that as this kind of work relationship becomes more pervasive, I suspect that there will be things like labor organizing that address some of these issues. I think right now it's largely peripheral to the vast majority of the economy, to the point that I think there's very little incentive for labor organizers or policymakers to do much about it. But I expect that it's going to be something we're going to see more of, and I think you're right, that the tension is so clear and so stark that it's hard not to look at some of this stuff and just see the huge image of Karl Marx hanging over it. So, anyway, thanks.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. Send it on down the wing there.
I'll speak up. One thing I was surprised you didn't speak to is actually the use of Mechanical Turk in trying to find the downed explorer Foskett in the desert.
I didn't mention it. Yeah.
And, you know, that there's this really interesting opportunity for the massed internet folks to use that cognitive surplus, there's Shirky's version of when you've got these down cycles to go and volunteer and do something.
Mm-hmm.
Did you look at where and why people are motivated to volunteer their time doing that and what other applications it could have when you mash it up with Google Maps or with Google Street View, mm-hmm. for instance, and what sort of privacy issues might turn up when you put all that focus on that mashup?
This kind of public data, yeah. The short answer to the question of whether we looked at that is no. The longer answer is I think that, you know, and it kind of relates back to the question you just asked as well, in the sense that I think the boundary, when you're talking about 1 cent for 5 minutes of your time, money does funny things to the way we think about activity in the world. And I think that the difference between 1 cent and a micro donation is so loaded socially and culturally that it's very hard to just remember, hey, wait, the difference between donating 5 minutes to the Smithsonian on the Extraordinaries iPhone app and between, you know, participating in a research project for 5 cents is just 5 cents. It's, you know, and so I think the it's something that I've been coming back to lately is that the symbolic value of the money or the donation is really humongous. But the actual difference, the concrete difference between the two is quite small. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of potential in what you're talking about. There are lots of wonderful examples about, you know, using sort of collective intelligence through large-scale volunteering efforts to contribute to positive social causes of various kinds. I think that they overlap quite closely with this and are maybe part of, you know, if you wanted to start thinking about it as a spectrum of some kind, I think they would fit together.
So a follow-up?
There's a lot of discussion online this week because Chris Anderson's book has come out.
Yeah, yeah.
This whole issue of free or freemium and where people choose to contribute or not based upon the perceived value of that contribution. Do you see any evidence or any kind of trend from your research in the quality of contributions based upon whether it's free, as in donated time, whether there is a 1 or 2 cent compensation. Like, in other words, if you're a nonprofit looking at this,
mm-hmm.
should you in fact attach a cost to get better results, or should it be free and to have people get some sort of societal benefit, like their name posted in the page, et cetera?
Right. I mean, that's some of the idea behind the kind of experiment that we're doing. I mean, all of our experiment at this stage is just within the confines of the Mechanical Turk system, right, where there's this expectation of payment. So even telling people you'll pay them no matter what, people may not actually believe you. I would love to think up a way to do a more serious study of exactly that kind of question. The experimental research that I've looked at that's asked some of those questions, I think, suggests that there are kind of subpopulations of people who would respond differently to the different kinds of approaches you're describing. So there are some people who really will be very motivated if you put them in a context where you tell them they're doing good and you let them compete against their friends to see who can give the most. And there are other people that, you know, don't really care about that, would rather just have their 5 cents, thank you very much, and not have to worry about it. So I think that, you know, what that suggests in a broader way is, one, probably need some better ways to test that in these contexts of, you know, large-scale collaborations on the internet, which is something I think that I and some other folks are interested in working on. But two, that, you know, it may be that there's a right approach for the right kind of people you're trying to reach at the right time. That comes off as sounding a little wishy-washy, but I think it's what the research suggests at this stage, at least the research that I've seen. So it's a nice reminder that, you know, we're not all homo economicus, which is, I think, probably a good thing. So thanks for your question. Is there someone else down the back there? Yeah.
Sure.
Oh, I'll wait. Sorry. So I'm sort of curious about the supply of hits and the people who are supplying them, and whether you see workers returning to the same employers over time, or whether they'll pretty much work for anybody, or whether people kind of are gaining skills or specializing in a particular kind of hit. Say, I only want to do language translation, or I only want to do image tagging, or if those sorts of, I guess, bucketings of people are taking place.
Yeah, yeah. I think it definitely happens to some degree within AMT. I don't really know in some of these other systems the extent to which that's taking place. But within AMT, absolutely. Two quick examples. Casting Words has a tracks worker performance over time, and they compensate people at higher rates who produce better work on shorter notice. So yes, there's one example of a company that's actively trying to use the system to do that. And I think, we'd have to talk to them to find out how well it works, or exactly the mechanics of how they make it happen. Another example of places where I think that definitely happens is on the Turker forums. Now, I don't have any real numbers about how many people are using those forums, what kind of slice of the larger demographic of Mechanical Turk is represented on those forums. But one interesting example is a blog post from 2008 that I was looking at recently where, you know, we have a list of requesters. I mean, this is another more information sharing about requesters to make it easier to find requesters who pay you more quickly or more responsive to your emails, offer higher compensation rates for the jobs that they post. And so this just has a listing of people and the kinds of hits that they post. And then let's see, I wanted to just see what other data points were in here. The payment time lag was a major concern for a lot of folks. So I think that definitely happens. I don't have any good aggregate sense of to what degree or extent or what the impact is on the system as a whole, or even on my own hits. I don't have any idea. So
one quick thing. So my advisor uses Turk for some of his studies, and he pays like 5 or 10 times the market rate.
Yeah.
Because he wants to, well, there are several reasons he pays it. Anyway, he pays a lot of money, and he gets emails from people asking him when his next job will be available.
Right, right. No, I mean, we're paying an inflated rate for the time that our hit requires. And part of that is to try to get faster feedback out of the system, because other folks have found, and we've found too, that people respond more quickly if you're offering more money based on the difficulty and time that the hit requires. So I wouldn't be surprised if there are folks who are, you know, I have to ask the Dolores Labs folks about this too, you know, whether there are people who contact them about their hits because they want to do their hits because they're a known quantity, or because they pay better. So, but I would imagine it's like any market. You have certain costs and benefits, these kinds of things. So, yeah. You want to go?
The question that's still, and I think is maybe many people's minds, is one that maybe you cannot answer with what you're doing now, which is why you think that it's presumably a lot of Americans, maybe even relatively affluent Americans, that would be doing this to begin with. And I don't know how you assumed or where you got it from that they might be affluent. Or could it be a sign of actually the fact that there might be more poverty in America than we would imagine, you know, among the 20, 30-somethings maybe even?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not as you suggested, I don't want to act like I have a real answer to why. The results themselves, as I suggested before, are not conclusive in any real way either. So I don't know the extent to which relatively affluent young Americans represent the system as a whole, right? I don't know how many workers are young affluent Americans. At the same time, you know, these self-selecting surveys have revealed that there are at least, you know, I think people's perception when they hear about a system like this is, oh, this is something that some, you know, a well-educated college student who has good job prospects would never do, even in a time of a recession. And I guess the interesting thing that I see coming out of even just these, like, these pictures is that that's just not the case. I mean, it's not clear to me that there's any reason to, you know, extrapolate based on the answers that these 50 people held up on their little note cards. But I think that the fact that people say, I do this for ramen money, which is another one of the note cards, is suggestive. I mean, I don't know if it means that the U.S. has a sort of weird underclass of 20-something people living at home with their parents. It may. But I wouldn't want to base any claims like that on what I know about Mechanical Turk at this stage. So.
And there is no serious survey.
Not to my knowledge. I asked one of the VPs of Mechanical Turk at Amazon about this. And apparently they've done some research, but I haven't been able to get my hands on it yet, and they implied to me that that it was not like a representative survey of the worker population, which actually surprised me, but it may be sort of a plausible deniability, willful ignorence sort of thing there too. So,
well, who's going to go home and try it out?
What do you mean? Who's going to go home and do a survey of...
Try
Turk? Oh, yeah. I've definitely done it. It's fun, but as long as you don't get a boring task. I don't know who is next, so maybe David?
Sure. I was just wondering how much information about requesters is available. I saw the requester name, but is there any other information, like on the official site or the Turker forums? Is there any vetting? Is there anything that stops you from, like, opening up a new requester account if you get a bad reputation on the forums or something like that?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a violation of the terms of service to have many accounts. It's definitely a violation of the terms of service to have multiple worker accounts. I haven't looked closely enough at the requester TOS to be totally certain about that. Something maybe TOU Watch can handle. Within Mechanical Turk, there's very little information, as I said before. So that's Turk Opticon, the extension I described. So those scores are contributed based on 12 reviews. It's very thin. And there's really no way to get information about folks. Now, on the forums and on other people's blogs, there's more information. And at least in the case of organizations that post jobs under the company name, so Casting Words, for example, here, you can go visit their website, find out more about who you're working for and what their jobs are about. But yeah, it's hit and miss and very uneven. So, yeah. Bill?
This is related to the question you just asked. Does Amazon advertise this in any way? Because I personally had never heard of Mechanical Turk
really?
Until this.
I mean, I learned about it this year in the course of doing some of this work. I think they advertise it as part of their, you know, some of their cloud services. I think the idea, I mean, they sort of frame it in their site as the human command line, like I said, so.
Yeah, it does seem like cloud computing and cloud
exactly.
Stuff.
You have a question you want to ask about these 10,000 blog posts? Go send 10,000 people to read them and pay them a little bit of money for each one. I beyond that, I'm not sure. I'm not sure the extent to which they're advertising it. I don't think it's a big moneymaker for them. Amazon basically charges requesters a 10% cut on every payment they make to workers. So for every 1 cent you pay a worker, you owe Amazon 1/10 of 1 cent. And it adds up when you do a couple thousand of these things, but it's never huge. So they do maintain a developer forum, which I suspect is their largest cost because they have a couple of folks who kind of keep an eye on the developer forum and answer questions. Beyond that, I'm not sure. So yeah, in the back.
So $3 an hour is not going to go a long way in the States, right? But there are plenty of places where it would.
Yeah.
The problem is that in a lot of these places, there is technological questions.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, there seem to be a lot of development. I mean, cell phones in Africa. a lot of countries where there's a lot of turmoil, but nevertheless there is technological capacity. Mm-hmm. Do you know, and I apologize, I came in late, so I apologize if you already addressed this, but do you know of any instances or any plans where either Amazon Turk or similar systems have been deployed to create jobs and to essentially provide income to and services to
poor populations outside of the U.S.
Essentially, populations involved. I mean, case in point, Iraq, a friend of mine worked there, and she said that one of the problems with volatility is that there's very high unemployment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It would be necessary to create jobs at a rate of about $4 an hour in order to significantly reduce, I believe, the unemployment was somewhere around 17-20%.
Right. Which is even higher than the U.S. right now.
Yeah.
There are a couple of different things I would say in response. One is I know of one organization that I should have written the person's name and the organization into this, which is a good reminder for next time. But sorry? No, I'm not thinking of Nathan Eagle. Although their work is related in this, which is an organization. Is it called Text Eagle?
Yeah, Text Eagle.
Text Eagle. They're distributing small-scale jobs via SMS and doing payment through cell phone payment. So it's micro jobs and micro payments over cell phones. Text Eagle is the organization's name. Very interesting. There's somebody else who's looking into starting something like that using Mechanical Turk, specifically, I forget which countries in Africa. I believe she's working in Kenya primarily. But I would have to look up her name since I don't know it offhand. Other than that, the main obstacle with Mechanical Turk are U.S. counterterrorism banking rules. You cannot have, it's very hard to get paid if you don't have a U.S. bank account. In part because those are rules that were imposed on Amazon in response to counterterrorism banking regulations that were passed after, as part of the Patriot Act. So, as a result, you get people from different parts of the world participating, but I suspect that that's a bigger block than digital divide related, you know, access issues at this stage. The other thing, there was one more thing. The one exception is India. Amazon itself in 2007 made it possible so that people can get paid in rupees in India. I was looking on some forums, sort of Indian make money on the internet websites a couple days ago, and it turns out people do have to submit personal identifying number, something which seems like it might be analogous to a social security, but don't quote me on that. I don't know enough about what the identifier actually is, that some people were anxious about contributing to a company over the internet without their knowledge of where it was going or what it would be used for. But at this stage, so our hit right now that we've been running has gotten about 1,000 responses. Of the 1,000, about 250 people say they're from India. I don't know if that I wouldn't take that and say that's a real percentage that you could apply to the rest of the population, but it gives you an idea that it's something that folks from India are using. So, yeah.
It's kind of related because I'm looking at what they put on the website. When you create a hit, it says that you can decide where you want your workers to come from. I mean, what is your level of control? I mean, don't they have this demographic data? And kind of you can like decide if you want a certain distribution of your raters and everything?
It's hard to actually do something like that. It's very hard to sort of say, I want 70% of people to come from the U.S. What I could do is I could say I had 100 hits. I had 100 jobs that I wanted to be done, and I wanted 70% from the U.S. and 30% from somewhere else. I could say, create one job with 70 that I was going to get 70 people to do and use a qualifying task to sort of say, you have to be from the U.S. to complete this job. And then for the other 30, impose a different qualifying task that says you have to be not from the U.S. to complete this job and then aggregate the results afterwards and go along my merry way. But it's not it's not totally easy to control. There are these qualifying tasks which you can use to exclude or include folks. So here's an example. Apparently I can't do that one either. I don't know what it was I did wrong this morning when I signed in to Mechanical Turk. Maybe I've already done some of these. But in any event, people definitely use qualifying tasks to exclude workers based on certain criteria, or include them based on certain criteria. So you could ask people to answer trial questions, and if they get a certain number of them wrong, you could prevent them from using, from doing your actual jobs.
I think my question was a little bit different. When you create a workers account, don't you fill in some demographic data that can use, I mean, that can later be used?
In theory, yes. I don't think, Amazon doesn't share that with requesters as part of the, like, designing and submitting a hit process. It's all part of this thing where they basically keep some block between the workers and the requesters so that I don't have easy access to workers' personal identifying information as a requester and vice versa. Workers don't have access to my identification except through a talk that's being posted on the internet. So yeah, it's not as easy as being able to say, check a few boxes when you just set up the hit to say, I only want folks who have bank accounts in the following countries or with the following banks. Other questions? Yeah.
It sounds like the low wages have not prevented Amazon from recruiting workers, but I wondered if you had any sense of whether the supply of Turk labor exceeds the demand or vice versa.
I have no good way of knowing. I mean, there's a steady supply of work and workers, at least in our experience with the hits we've been running and with other folks who I've talked with, worked with about this kind of stuff. I think that, if I remember correctly, the Amazon folks didn't clarify whether this was registered or active users, but it was something in the 100,000s of workers. I have no good way of knowing. I know that they provide an aggregate number of how many hits are available right now at the top of the page, and that's about it. They won't, you know, I think they like to sort of make it just seem like there's a lot of work and a lot of workers out there.
Just some requests go unresponded to for a long time?
Yeah, no, and there are definitely sort of things within the system that'll make you more likely to get responses versus less likely.
But it's not labor supply, whether it's well written or...
Yeah, at this stage it doesn't seem like it's strictly speaking labor supply. I mean, I don't think if I were to try to graph the demand and supply curve for this market, I don't think that I would sort of, I guess I'm too much of a sociologist, so I would look at it and assume that something else was going on before it was sort of pure market efficiencies and inefficiencies. One example that we just had that sort of supports that idea is that we had to extend a hit. So, you know, you get to post a deadline of how long the hit can last before it comes off the site, and ours wasn't done yet. We knew it wouldn't be done yet, so we wanted to extend it. Extending it bumped it up in the search results, and we immediately got a deluge of more people coming in and completing our hit. So it suggests that, you know, sort of the older, less well-paying hits might sort of languish for a while, irrespective of what the sort of supply and demand of labor was.
But even the menial, low-pay tasks get workers.
In my experience, yes. Yeah. I mean, it does vary. The guy who did the photo, the first two pictures he posted trying to pay people 2 cents, and he only got two, one of whom, the middle one on the top there, is a friend of his. That sheet of paper says, I do this to amuse Andy, something like that, or for Andy's amusement. I Turk for Andy's amusement, I think is what it says. He upped it to 25 cents and got 10 or 15 more, and then upped it to 50 and got 30 or 40 more. So, I mean... But what does that mean? Who the hell knows? That's sort of it's one guy's experience, where he was actually asking people to reveal what they look like as well. So a very strange kind of request within Turk. So, yeah.
Seems like if this becomes a significant part of the economy as opposed to a little fringe activity that people do for lulz, there are some potential for, you know, thorny issues like racial and ethnic discrimination to occur that sort of walk around the current laws on that subject.
Mm-hmm.
And has anybody thought about that? Has Amazon thought about it?
I don't know the extent to which, I mean, I suspect that Amazon's lawyers have thought about it.
The question is, you know, I don't know what kind of information the requesters get
from the workers as far as, well, if they only want, you know, black women between 20 and 25, you know, can they do that, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
That they could lie.
Yeah, so how would you, yeah, how would you discriminate in,
I don't know,
the most...
If everyone knows you're a dog, if no one knows you're a dog on the internet, then no one knows you're a black woman at the age of 25, right?
Right, yeah.
That's true, too.
I just don't.
I mean, I suspect that the discrimination in this kind of thing is tough. at least in Mechanical Turk, where the sort of social layer of the site is so thin. It may be different. It may be different in other contexts.
And there are ways to select only the workers you really want.
Well, there are ways to provide qualifying tasks. It's very hard to know when people are telling the truth.
Okay.
My only metric for qualifying tasks may be, can you get these questions right? In which case, I may be discriminating, but it's a sort of structural discrimination that I'm not liable for usually. Yeah, exactly. I suspect that the labor regulation piece is probably a more pressing kind of policy / regulatory issue, more likely to bubble up as this kind of work or kind of, you know, relationship with companies becomes more widespread. But that's not to say that some forms of discrimination couldn't also play into it. So, all right. Oh, one more. Oh, I'm sorry.
I have a follow-up question from Esther via the IRC channel.
Awesome.
And she wanted to comment on the comparison with volunteer work and saying that she doesn't necessarily think that that's an apt comparison, because when people volunteer, they often get other rewards that aren't monetary. Like, they might build up reputation, or they might feel like they're contributing to the common good. Even something like Wikipedia, if you're using your cognitive surplus to edit Wikipedia, even though you're not getting paid, you feel like you're contributing to a project that has a purpose that maybe you believe. So she was wondering what your thoughts on that were. First,
on whether it's on the fact that it may not be a fair comparison.
Well,
between,
in terms of why people choose to do this, like, what is the motivation for participation?
Did you want to jump in?
I didn't say that anyone who fills out a psych survey for a candy bar is doing it because someone asked them. It's not a pure market exchange in a research context. So I think people give money in partial monetary compensation and partly for other things.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that people do things that are not, I mean, your statement that people do, like, that people may do partial monetary compensation activities all the time is apt. I think that, you know, I would go back to the thing I was saying earlier, where I think there's a lot of symbolic value to the 5 cents, which doesn't make it any less real. It doesn't make the sort of distaste that some people have for being offered a penny in exchange for their time. I mean, it's really strong. And actually, I'm thinking of Esther when I say that, because she and I have had this conversation. I know she sort of is like, gets just angry at the idea. And I think that that's, you know, I wouldn't downplay that response at all. And I think that there are probably a lot of people who will respond much more strongly to being presented with a large sort of a big goal, a big social goal, like finding someone who's been lost in an airplane accident or contributing to the largest free encyclopedia. And they may be more motivated to participate. But I wouldn't downplay the fact that some people, you know, are perfectly content to do something that they don't know anything about for a nickel. And, you know, maybe it's just for ramen or for lulz, but it's because of that, the fact that these motivations are diverse and that ultimately the tasks are not fundamentally different, that I would put it on a continuum, and that I would see the two as connected, not because I think that the people will automatically perceive them as being the same. So hopefully that was satisfactory, Esther. Sorry if not. Yeah, Chris.
So I wanted to actually talk about the flip side of what Alice brought up earlier, which is the issue of labor laws and minimum wage. You know, I read Freakonomics a year or two ago, and they mentioned that most drug dealers make minimum wage or lower, but one of the upsides of that is that drug dealer employers don't garnish wages for alimony and child support or taxes. And so, you know, if you are in a position where your wages are being garnished due to bankruptcy or for whatever reasons there are, you can make money, I assume, on Amazon Turk and not have, you get to keep your $3 an hour as opposed to having someone reach into your pocket and take out two of it every day.
Yeah, and you may owe taxes. I mean, yeah, they have tax reporting requirements based on how much workers make in a given year and as well as how much requesters pay individual workers. So I would have to file tax paperwork for you if you earn $600 a year or more from me in hits. But that's all self-reporting stuff. It's the same as the rest of the tax code, which basically relies on some mix of enforcement and honesty. The larger point, though, I think, yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, Chris, that I think there may be people, given their situations, may have incentives to earn money in this way that are not sort of purely economic, or maybe they are purely economically rational in the sense that you can earn more money and keep more of it in your pocket if you do it like this. So, yeah, Rasmus.
I mean, I'd like to just to return to the question of the different kind of incentives at play here. And, I mean, you've told us a lot about how you think these things play together, but is there anything in your research design that provide an empirical answers to the question of how these different incentives play together? And
somewhat. I mean, the
one big invitation to jump into that question, since that seems to be on everybody's mind here, is the question of whether or under what conditions do monetary incentives crowd out other incentives?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things we're looking at in this experiment. I don't know why my bar keeps coming up in the top there, but this experiment is to compare different kinds of incentives or motivational framings with the same task. So we're asking lots of people to do the same thing, and we're framing it in different ways, and we're going to see whether the results are significantly different depending on the framings.
But with all of them, you pay people the same amount of money.
There's a baseline rate. Some people have the opportunity to earn financial bonuses based on their performance, and some are presented with other sorts of motivational framings for the job. So in some cases, we're saying, congratulations, you're a member of the red team. You will earn bonuses based on, so it's still a financial incentive in this case, but you'll earn bonuses based on the performance of other members of your team, as opposed to just your individual performance. And so,
is there any way where you can offer these tasks on a platform that is not built around monetary compensation?
Within Mechanical Turk, no. I mean, it would have to be elsewhere outside of Mechanical Turk. But yes, there absolutely is. I mean, we're not personally right. Was
we
it?
Have. Well, we could use what we have.
Yeah, we could use. I mean, the site that the application that Jason and Anita have built can be run independent of Mechanical Turk, and has been run independent of Mechanical Turk several times. And this may be the kind of thing where I'm trying to think of other. I mean, people have started doing some more studies of things like voluntary donation in exchange for file sharing and things like that. I mean, this may be places where monetary exchange is not the norm, where sort of a employee-employer relationship is not the baseline, and that may have a very significant effect on how people perform and what expectations they enter into the exchange with. So, I mean, in terms of the Mechanical Turk experiments that we're running, it's not, strictly speaking, going to be able to test that. As a broader question, it's definitely something that, in various ways, I think a couple of different some projects at Berkman and other folks elsewhere are working on.
Related to that, is there an equivalent that pays people in points towards something instead of money?
Mm-hmm.
And could you tell whether there's a difference in the incentives when it's not money, but it is sort of a material incentive,
mm-hmm.
whether that changes people's behavior?
Again, I mean, I'm not aware of too many places right now that are testing this, you know, monetary, non-monetary compensation specifically. There are lots of places online where people are getting non-monetary compensation where they seem very highly motivated to, you know, inordinately give of themselves to some group or goal or
right. Project.
But
if it was something, if you're saying this is my MP3 money, if they just gave people MP3s or points towards MP3s instead of actually 5 cents, which seems to be insulting, whether that would make a difference in how people
can choose to get paid out.
I don't know if it directly answers it. I mean, but yes, you can get paid in sort of gift certificates to Amazon in the case of Mechanical Turk. It's basically money. Some people use that as a way to launder their payments, actually. But
there has been research on how people treat scripts versus cash versus obligation witnesses. So
sure.
It'd be interesting to see if Mechanical Turk was different or changed that environment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it's different from volunteering as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's stuff in terms of where people participate. There's been lots of work on open source development communities, right? So there's one example of a place where people are giving a lot and not always getting the return in monetary form, very rarely in a lot of people's case, although more and more people are getting paid for their development time in open source.
So what they're getting back is intangible, right? So
they're probably in terms of survey responses, yes, people say that they're getting back, you know, identity and the use of software that is valuable to them and sort of a sense of achievement and creativity, and all of those things are very valuable to folks. I mean, the other example that Yokai always likes to cite is the groups in distributed computing sites. So people contribute to distributed computing platforms where you sort of let your computer's free time be used up by a larger project. And on some of them, they form teams. And so a lot of the teams are these sort of, you know, geographically paired, geographic origin groups. So you'll have the French team of distributed computing folks. But then there's one that's the Knights Who Say Nee. So it may just be that, you know, folks get a kick out of being involved in something like that. And the Knights Who Say Nee perform very well against the other countries in terms of distributed computing. So I think there's a lot to suggest that, you know, what you're saying, that there, for some people, I think that non-financial incentives and non-financial sort of compensation, even though that's the wrong word because it conjures money, may be equally or more effective. I'm not so aware of how we would operationalize that kind of thing in this, but Alan may know of other folks that are doing it better, and I'm sure there are other folks out here who do. But
just small thing. Looking at it as a game, like one thing about the ESP game.
Oh yeah. Like another perfect example.
Right. Of course, that is kind of contributing to the collective good of labeling, you know, the world's images, but at the same time, Louis Fanon was reporting that when he was asking users why do they do it, and they would write in, "Thank you for helping me to learn English."
Mm-hmm.
Right. So like, oh, I typed in the word correctly, and I got some feedback. Someone agrees with me that I got it right. So I did some tasks, and someone approved it. It didn't matter that it was 2 cents. It was just some token that was passed around.
Right.
And you know, it was useful for someone. But then I'm getting this kind of feedback cycle. And then the other thing on minimum wage, you know, many people might be doing it during their regular jobs.
Right. That's definitely true. I mean, I think there are lots of jobs that you could have a perfectly good time just sitting at your computer and doing this. So you may be able to make a little money in addition to that. But the games with a purpose and the ESP game stuff is all a very apt example completely. They're doing it for the greater good of Google image search at this point, I think, right? But we'll take that as the collective good. Maybe Chris won't, but you know, the rest of us might. All right, thanks very much, everyone. Really appreciate the comments and discussion.